Matthew Crawford's critique of the distrustful attitude toward creation, promoted by the philosophy of René Descartes, is similar to criticisms offered by other thinkers, who've made the case that the rationalism promoted by Descartes led Western thought astray. Descartes' quest for certainty led to a suspicion of the knowledge conveyed by the senses. As Michael Gillespie summarizes it, quote, "For Descartes, everything that we know is known only when it is represented upon the screen of the imagination by the will. Thus, the world only truly is when it is represented rather than sensed or imagined, that is, only when it is factual in a literal sense as something made or constructed, factual from the Latin facere, to make," close quote. Later, Gillespie concludes, quote, "The artesian human being is thus at its core a self-positing, self-grounding being. Man in this way ceases to be considered the rational animal and instead is conceived as the willing being," close quote. This passage, by the way, is from Gillespie's book, The Theological Origins of Modernity. The 20th century Italian philosopher Augusto Del Noce similarly argued that there was a line between the rationalism of Descartes and the nihilism of Nietzsche, a rationalism that is founded on skepticism, that is suspicious of the knowledge gained from experience or tradition, that trusts the knowing subject more than the reality of the known objects, can easily end up where it begins, with a self-enclosed skepticism. In a 1982 essay called The Idea of Modernity, Del Noce wrote, quote, "According to Descartes, the first certainty is that there is an I who freely doubts natural reality, that is, deprives it of reality," close quote. That essay by Augusto Del Noce is contained in an anthology called The Crisis of Modernity, recently published by McGill Queen's University Press and translated by Carlo Lancelotti. Del Noce, who lived from 1910 to 1989, was a professor at La Sapienza University of Rome and a public intellectual in post-war Italy. Almost none of his work has been translated into English, probably because it was long regarded as unfashionable within the academy. Early in his intellectual pilgrimage, Del Noce argued against the Catholic left, among others, that the atheism in Karl Marx's ideas was not a superficial accessory in an essentially sound socio-political analysis, but, as his translator Lancelotti summarizes, quote, "All of Marx's thought is a consistent development of the radical metaphysical principle that freedom requires self-creation, and thus the rejection of all possible forms of dependence, especially dependence on God," close quote. As Del Noce himself argued, atheism is not the conclusion, but rather the precondition of the whole system of Marxist thought. Translator Carlo Lancelotti is a professor of mathematics and a member of the graduate faculty in physics at the City University of New York, who's long admired Del Noce's work and lamented its unfamiliarity to English-speaking readers. When we talked about Del Noce, we began by examining his claim that Marxism is the singly most influential intellectual movement of the 20th century, despite its practical failures.
He thinks that Marxism is what he calls the protagonist of contemporary history. I mean, he really pushes it back even before the 20th century. I mean, remember that Del Noce started as a scholar of early French philosophy, in particular Descartes and rationalism. So to him, the great question was to follow the development of rationalism in Europe. And in his view, Marx was the final point of the development of European rationalism. And after Marx, it has been decomposing, no more evolving, so to speak. His idea was that the beginning of rationalism was not the denial of God, but rather the denial of original sin, as he said at some point in the book. He says that studying the libertines and Descartes and other people in the 1600s, he realized that their big issue was not to deny God per se, but to deny original sin. And now this developed, it came to Marx to the conclusion that in order to affirm that humans can achieve heaven on earth, that humans can fulfill themselves, you must deny also God. But the denial of God in Marx is not a conclusion, it says it's a presupposition, because in a sense, in order to be free, humans have to create themselves through their work. And so in order to create themselves through their work, they cannot be created by somebody else. So his reading of Marx is very theological. He's not interested in Marx as a political thinker or as a political economist. He's interested in Marx as a metaphysician, as a fundamental philosopher. And then the second reason it gives for the why Marx for him was crucial is because in Marx, rationalism reached the masses. Because if you follow European history up to Marx, he says rationalism was really an elite phenomenon. It was first, you know, the libertines of the time of Pascal, and then it was the philosophers of the Enlightenment age. But then with Marx, there is this idea that rationalism becomes a religion, and becomes a religion by theorizing the revolution. To him, Marx is a thinker of revolutionary thought, the idea that the world is moving towards an immanent perfection as opposed to the transcendent perfection of traditional theology. And so in this promise of an immanent perfection in the world, the idea of the revolution, Marx was able to reach the masses and to produce mass movements. And so that's why, to him, Marx was really an end point in that sense.
That word revolution, he thinks about revolution not so much in political or economic terms, but revolution as a philosophical act.
Yes, in the sense that there is going to be a change of what he calls it, using a Gnostic terminology, eon, E-O-N, meaning that there is going to be a transition from the age of enslavement to the age of freedom, from the age of repression to the age of liberation. That ultimately, as opposed to, say, an Augustinian understanding of history in which ultimately the total amount of sin, if you wish, is to some extent conserved through time. I mean, you know, maybe it shifts in different areas, but more or less every generation participates in the fall of Adam. And so, in a sense, history will never be freed from sin. There is the sense that the revolution is a metaphysical transition to a higher state, of freedom, to the reign of freedom, which is the religious aspect of Marx. What I think is one of his most interesting insights is that in Marx there are two aspects. There is the aspect of historical materialism, which is this idea that ultimately economics and material realities shape history. And there is this idea of the revolution as a transition to a sort of immanent heaven, to a new man. And in fact, the core of the Noge's interpretation of the 20th century is that these two aspects turn out to be contradictory, and that you cannot at the same time think that impersonal material forces like the economy and sociology drive history, and also that history has this kind of destiny towards freedom and the revolution. And his interpretation of what happened in the 20th century is that these two things split apart. And in a sense, he argues that today the West, even if communism was defeated, the West, meaning we, have maintained the materialistic aspect of Marx while dropping the revolutionary aspect.
He also talks about Marxism in terms of the denial of the primacy of being over becoming, or I think somewhere also talks about the importance of doing rather than being, being present in Marxism, but really present in modernity as such, not just in Marxism?
Yes, definitely. I mean, the idea of the opposition between becoming and being really goes back to Hegel, more than Marx. I mean, again, the sense that there is no other reality, so ultimately everything has to die. He likes to quote Engels, who said that everybody that is born deserves to die. So, and that includes values. I mean, Del Noce was a big observer of the culture of the 60s, and he observed this fact that with respect to somebody like him who was born in 1910, what was being lost is the awareness that there are unchangeable values. Really, values are a product of sociological circumstances, are a product of economic developments, and so everything becomes. There is nothing unchanging. I mean, this was his big, for instance, complaint about the way people understood the sexual revolution. because many, for instance, Catholics or Christians at the time thought that the sexual revolution was just a sociological phenomenon, you know, that in some sense there was more money, there was more technology, the pill was invented, and so because of all these phenomena, okay, then moral customs change, and, you know, and mores change, and maybe they will come back. But instead, he had a strong sense that really there was a philosophical assumption behind, which is what you just mentioned, the idea that really, say, sex or family does not have in any way to conform to some order or to some platonic idea or to anything unchangeable in order to flourish, but that rather is just, it just happens, and in a sense there is nothing behind. Hmm. There is no meaning ultimately.
And there's no meaning because if there were any real meaning, it would be determinable by science. This gets to his critique of scientism also.
Exactly. I don't think it would. To him, science by its very nature cannot determine a meaning. I mean, science can establish a relationship between phenomena. You can observe that certain phenomena follow from other phenomena. You can make some quantitative estimates of how things turn out, but ultimately science cannot affirm a meaning just by its very structure.
Uh-huh. And so he talks about scientism as a totalitarian conception of science, that science is the only source of true knowledge.
That's very important.
Yeah, it's interesting that he discusses this in a number of the essays you've translated, but he is very explicit about it in the chapter on eroticism. So on a chapter written, I think, in 1970, mm-hmm. Talking about the sexual revolution, mm-hmm. which he sees as much a function of scientism and a philosophical assumptions behind scientism.
Exactly. He believes that the sexual revolution is the ethics of scientism as a philosophy. Mm-hmm. And that if you embrace scientism as a philosophy, the corresponding ethical outlook is what he calls eroticism, meaning the sexual revolution ideology. And again, I think he's right. I mean, the point he was observing the phenomena of the 60s again, and he observed that basically, if you look at today, the consensus is that the only source of morality for sex, for instance, is some kind of consent, but it's not that sex otherwise has any meaning. It's not that sex has to do, say, with a vocation or has anything to do with the order of the universe or has it to do with the teleos, like having children. You know, it's just something, there is an instinct. You can study scientifically what instincts people have, but once you determine what the instincts are, why shouldn't they follow the instincts? I mean, it's just, in that sense, it's scientific, because he quotes a Wilhelm Reich, who was a Austrian psychoanalyst, to the effect that the idea of marriage is already platonic, teleological. He assumes that the human life serves some purpose, but if science does not recognize purpose, science just observes the facts, and given the facts, all there is the instincts, so who can say anything about that? Mm.
There's an odd circularity there, because science as a method assumes that it can set aside purpose in order to understand empirical mm-hmm. phenomena, but it doesn't necessarily presuppose the non-existence of purpose. It just says we're going to bracket those questions for now. So it's odd that people would think that science somehow proves that there is no purpose.
You're exactly right. Science doesn't do that. That's the difference between science and scientism. Scientism is not science. Scientism is an ideology that absolutizes science. And incidentally, that's why Delnoce makes these comments about scientism, not science, but mm-hmm. scientism being totalitarian. It's totalitarian in as much it denies what he says, the universality of reason, which is a bit of a mouthful, but what he means is that, you know, just like for Marx, for instance, there was bourgeois reason and proletarian reason, and arguments from non-communists could be discarded because they reflected the class interest. Or for the Nazis, there was Aryan art and Jewish art, you know what I mean? And so basically, there is just in the same way, today you can see that often people have what consider scientific arguments, and if something does not fall into a scientific framework, it does not belong in the public square, for instance. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's very typical that philosophical or metaphysical arguments or arguments based on natural law are rejected from public debate, exactly because of an implicit scientism, the idea that you only certain type of knowledge is acceptable. Mm-hmm. And but then those who don't fit in that type of knowledge cannot speak, in a sense.
Hmm. I've been reading a lot of David L. Schindler lately, and his discussion of the fact that the assumption that we can set aside metaphysical claims in public debate is itself a metaphysical assumption.
of course.
It assumes something about the nature of human being and the nature of society.
Absolutely. I mean, the notion says that there is no human gesture or human action that does not imply an overall narrative, an overall perception of who we are. You know, it's really being human that by anything we do, we affirm something. But in this case, I mean, the other thing that should be said about scientism is that, you know, scientism existed already in the 19th century, of course, at the time of positivism and before the war. And to Del Noce, again, that kind of this big rebirth of scientism after the Second World War, especially in the 1950s, is not due to science. Mm-hmm. Is due to a reaction against the disasters of the 20th century. I mean, he says very, very clearly that after the 1930s, Nazis, fascism, Stalinism, after World War II, people built a certain narrative to explain what had happened. And in this narrative, what was responsible for Auschwitz and for the Gulag was, in some sense, some kind of metaphysics. Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, this was not formulated always clearly, but they regarded Marxism and Nazism as expressions of some kind of decadent, romantic philosophy of history. And so as a reaction to that, in the 1950s, people said, well, the vaccine against totalitarianism will be to go back to the Enlightenment, mm-hmm. in the sense of the appreciation of science, scientific rationality, downgrading the role of tradition. You know, we can think of many authors in the 1950s. I don't know. Have you ever interviewed by any chance George Marston? You know, you wrote
In fact, I interviewed him about his most recent book on the 50s. Yeah.
Exactly. I was about to quote that book because if you read that book, especially in the first part, it gives you a very good sense of how really what came out in the 60s was really a result of certain cultural presuppositions that, by and large, were well established by the 50s. Mm-hmm. And Del Noce would say they were established in the 50s as an attempt to make sense of the disasters of the 20th century. Hmm.
You point out in the beginning of your essay, your translator's introduction, that you admire Del Noce's capacity as someone who can reconstruct intellectual genealogies. And, mm-hmm. and as I read these essays, I was struck by the fact that he is really as much a cultural critic as he is a philosopher, that he's really providing a historical situated understanding of ideas, both implicit ideas and explicit ideas and their consequences.
Well, I think he did have a particular skill. I mean, I think that he was very insightful at the psychological level. He had this habit. It's a habit of mind of asking the question of what general worldview is behind this position. I mean, there is one essay in which he talks about miniskirts. He says, one could think that this is a frivolous example, but is there a certain self-understanding of or vision of the world that would prompt somebody to wear a miniskirt? Or I mean, this really profound conviction that human beings are junkies for meaning, and that everything they do relies at least implicitly on some interpretation or some
they act for reasons. There are reasons behind it.
Exactly. And that ideas also, he felt that ideas have their own logic. There is a passage that he then quote in the introduction where he says that a philosopher is free to choose his premises, but then he has to follow the consequences of his premises. Mm-hmm. And this is what gave his philosophy sometimes this strange predictive power. I mean, I don't know if you noticed, there is this essay, the one you mentioned on eroticism from 1970, which he talks about homosexual marriages. Mm-hmm. For instance, as early as 1963, he predicted that Marxism was toast, in a sense. Mm-hmm. I mean, but he didn't do this because he was a proud, because he used to dig down and see what are the ideas and what will happen to them if they're followed to their ultimate logic. Mm-hmm. Where this came from, I think there is a couple of explanations besides his individual knack for it. One is that he grew up in the 20s and 30s in Italy, which was a very historicistic culture. It was a culture shaped by Hegelian philosophy, mostly, in which there was a sense that of history, you know, that the human affairs are always developmental, and that we all carry the burden of the past, and that the past shapes us to some extent. And so it was much more historically oriented than it is now, or that it is also in the U.S. The other thing, I think, that he was very sensitive to the political realities. You know, he found himself, when he was a young man, under fascism, and then he lived very dramatically the Second World War in his early 30s, and then communism, I mean, at least Marxism. And this raised a lot of questions. There is that passage in the essay on violence and secularized Gnosticism, which he says that to his generation, they viewed Europe as the fruit of centers of civilization, and then it fell apart on them. I mean, that in the 30s, he seems to make a sudden turn towards barbarism. You know? And this contradiction was very painful, and so he had a struggle to understand where this was coming from. He was, in a sense, really shaped by the great European tragedies of the 1930s and 40s. But certainly many people were. He had a particular talent to try to understand where this was coming from.
Carlo Lancelotti, professor of mathematics and a member of the graduate faculty in physics at the City University of New York, and the translator of The Crisis of Modernity, a collection of essays by Augusto Del Noce. In his translator's introduction to the volume, Lancelotti writes, quote, Del Noce's keen perception of the interplay between the history of ideas and the history of facts is one of the reasons why, 25 years after his death, he remains an original and engaging intellectual figure. In his native Italy, he is widely regarded as one of the preeminent political thinkers and philosophers of the second half of the last century, precisely because of his ability to reconstruct intellectual genealogies and to expose the deep metaphysical premises of social and political movements. His own lifetime, 1910 to 1989, was marked by the two world wars and by the rise of and fall of the Marxist-Leninist revolutionary dream and of the totalitarian systems that either shared in it or opposed it. Del Noce maintained that 20th century history must be understood as a philosophical history in a specific and unique way, because during that period, Western culture was profoundly affected by the philosophies of history of the previous century, idealism, Marxism, positivism. These philosophies had become the secular neo-Gnostic surrogate of Christianity for the European-educated classes after the French Revolution, and the next century put them to the practical test, bringing to light their ultimate and necessary consequences. Close quote. I think that we're still witnessing the consequences of those philosophies of history. I think that contemporary culture is still in the grip of a dream of progress, not so much a confident progress toward something as the desperate progress of something, the restless acquisition of more and more power, power in the form of technological prowess, and the elimination of barriers for the assertion of human willing. But there is no telos in view, no end, no transcendent goal. In fact, those of us who believe that true progress requires recognition of and submission to transcendent ends are now regarded as enemies of progress, and increasingly enemies of civic order and the common good. At such a moment, Augusto Del Noce's analysis of the metaphysics of Marx, of miniskirts, and of other aspects of modernity is a valuable and practical contribution.